It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists. With your host, Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can recreate unique interactions and conversations.
And we are doing that today via Zoom, of course, because that's what everybody's doing now in this time of COVID. But today we are talking about the art and science of environmental awareness. And we have two very creative and yet very science-influenced guests with us today from the University of Kansas, where she's a visual artist and an educator. We welcome Gina Westergaard. Welcome, Gina.
Thank you.
And from right here in Indianapolis, Indiana, the one, the only, Jim Poyser, the executive director, founder of Earth Charter Indiana, also an accomplished author and playwright. Jim, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be with you.
Well, I think maybe, Mark, do you think we want to have each of our guests kind of give just a little brief background on what they do in case people aren't familiar with their work?
Yeah, I think that'd be great. Why don't we start with Gina? Just tell us a little bit about what you do at the University of Kansas, and then your art personally would be great.
All right. I'm an associate professor of metalsmithing and jewelry. And my desire to understand loss and death greatly influences my work as a metalsmith. So I've been creating one-of-a-kind funerary urns and reliquaries for about 20 years. And my work is starting to shift now from the more formalistic vessels to making narrative memorials to honor endangered and threatened animal species. And my husband and I are organic farmers. Actually, my husband is. I just tag along for the fun of it. And the experiences with nature and my observations of the cycles of life influence the narrative components of the new work I'm doing about the animals. And I can say I'm not a scientist and I'm not a therapist or a minister, so I have to use my strengths somehow. And I like to use my strengths as an artist to address the topic of death, which is obviously complex and challenging to do verbally. So, you know, I hope my art can raise awareness through these topics.
Jim?
Wow. Thank you, Gina. that was beautifully put. And having seen your work, too, that was really fun to hear your description about yourself. Many of your listeners, Mark and Jill, might remember me from my long stint as managing editor of Nouveau News Weekly. And so I worked in the world of journalism covering visual artists like Gina and other activists and political figures over the two decades I was at Nouveau. But I really lucked into the position of executive director with Earth Charter Indiana, which is a statewide nonprofit based on the principles of the Earth Charter that connects the climate crisis to poverty, racism, and lack of democratic transparency. So it really kind of connects everything. You really can't solve the climate crisis until you solve racism. And you can't solve racism until you solve poverty. And even though it makes it sound like it makes it more complicated, the truth is we haven't really solved any of our giant challenges as we see them all colliding and crashing into each other during this period of time. But before all this, I think I probably principally identified as a screenwriter and a playwright. And so I got into the newspaper business kind of just to be close to writing, to be close to words, and really put aside my fiction writing, screen writing, and for the most part, my playwriting in lieu of the, you know, the big business, the heavy business, the the very difficult business of running a newspaper. Earth Charter Indiana, now 7 years into my tenure there, and I work with kids, and I guess one mission statement would be that we empower youth to pair with adult allies to create intergenerational climate action on a local level. And because I work with kids, I'm constantly in the arts because kids want to use art to express their concerns about what Gina was talking about. Endangered animals are high on the list with kids. And so about 12 months ago, I decided that I was going to bring back arts into my life in a big way. And I began to write short plays about the climate crisis that I called Climate Follies. And I was geared toward producing and performing those at the Indie Fringe in August of 2020. And so I was launched into this theater thing, which has been a lot of fun, and it's taken a lot of different forms now that I'm sure we'll talk about. But then the COVID silver lining occurred where I dug up an old, 25-year-old novella I'd written about a global pandemic. I dug that up and just shared it with some friends. And coincidentally, one of my friends had taken over ownership of a small press. And she decided to publish that novella. And so I'm now a published author of a group of short stories called The Last Actor and Other Stories, which is a dream come true that I had completely given up on ever happening to me.
That ties us really well together. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. And I want to ask each of you specifically about the art aspect of the causes that you're involved with. And Jim, I want to go back, and if you help us all remember again, one of the very first projects that Earth Charter Indiana did was very creative, very artistic, and very effective. And it involved straws, drinking straws.
Oh, yeah, some of these memories will be traumatic. That one is definitely. I need to take a quick breath here about that one. So you know, the climate crisis and the sixth mass extinction that we find ourselves in have giant components, and then components that don't appear to be that giant. And, you know, for me, it's kind of like a series of pet peeves. I think that leaf blowers will be a big motif in my collection of short comedies about the climate crisis. And just akin to that is my frustration around straws. If you're an astronaut, you need a straw. If you have a dental condition, a disability of some kind where you need a straw, it's like, you know, you need a straw, that's fine. But about 97% of the straws that exist on planet Earth are necessary. And so I decided that I would kind of scratch this itch of irritation around straws by manifesting a pun of straws by creating a straw bale. So I collected used straws, which is part of the trauma I'm talking about, right? I had to collect used straws, and I rode my bike to different restaurants, so I was keeping my carbon footprint low, and I would bring those straws home, and I would wash them with water from my rain barrel. I mean, I was deep into this rabbit hole. And then I would eventually fashioned about 7,000 of these straws into a straw bale that I then used. I carted it around to schools and, you know, had to put it in a couple of exhibits and that sort of thing. So Jill, you reminded me of that. I'm a pass through my trauma, and I'm feeling a lot better about the straw bell, remembering it fondly.
Well, and it made a huge impact too, because you got your Earth Charter kids involved in that, and that really got them going. And it was right on the cusp of the time before the rest of the nation started realizing nobody really needs drinking straws either. And that movement has definitely moved forward, which is very exciting. Gina, you say you're not a scientist, but in a way you are, because you're a metallist, and you there's a lot of science that goes into the techniques that you use in your metal work, especially the pieces that you use when it comes to your elevating the endangered species and why we need to learn more about them. Explain that process a little bit.
Well, I think it's interesting that Jim mentioned that he wanted to bring back art into his life, and I'm probably the opposite of that. I wanted to bring back the environment and my views of living a healthy life, and my, I don't know if it's activism, but they're passionate views, let's just put it that way. So one of the things I'm thinking about is I want to get a bee colony and start to raise honeybees. And with those honeybees, I can take the wax and work the wax into some new work. But also, I use this technique called electroforming, and it literally takes something that's organic. Some of your listeners may be familiar with like bronze baby shoes, which would take a leather baby shoe and coat it with a layer of a paint that has metal in it, and through the electrical process, it will create something that's a permanent. So you could take a baby shoe and make it into a permanent bronze sculpture. So I want to use this technique on the dead bees in the colony. I'm hoping not to have too many of them, but some reliquary and memorial to the honeybees. And also, the honeybees, of course, having an organic farm, they're going to work well with the whole ecosystem and the balance of that. So I think it's all really exciting. I know nothing about beekeeping, but I'm not afraid of them. So I'm really eager to start. We were going to start this past summer, but of course, again, with COVID, it kind of put everything on hold. So I'm hoping next summer I will have more stories to tell you about the encapsulating bees into the electroforming process.
You also used that process in a series of art pieces and that were on display at the Harrison Center in the summer of 2020 during one of their months of local art as well. That really, they were beautiful pieces, but they were also very powerful in that they were leopards and mountain lions and cougar heads, which sounds really weird as I'm trying to describe them. So why don't you describe them?
Okay, I would call them my metalsmith's trophy animals.
There we go.
So I don't hunt and I don't eat mammals, but a hunter once told me his taxidermist made the animals that he hunted look better than when they were alive. And that really stuck with me. And I thought, okay, I'm a metalsmith. Why not use some of my strengths as an artist? And I decided to make my own trophy animals that honored certain species, like the Florida panther and just the tiger in general. It's one of the top endangered animals. The couple of the pieces that you saw at the Harrison Center for the Arts, one was where I took the foam armatures that are used, that taxidermy use, and I carved them and textured them, and then I did this electroforming technique. So I took the foam armatures and turned them into copper heads. And then I also used different plants from the farm, and you can use that same technique And then another, the tiger, I did some sculpting with a epoxy sculpting material, and then I electroformed over that. So it was important for me to really take what these people are using in the kill and as armatures, and to take something and make my creative statement with the heads.
When you do this process, and you're working with something that you know is, endangered for us, and it's not always necessarily a positive thing. And then you're working also with it from your background in funerary and objects that memorialize, but I would say also celebrate. Would that be a good word? Something that is passing from us away. Can you describe a little bit of that celebrate? I mean, I think your work, when I look at it, it looks very celebratory of it. I know it's sad in the passing, and yet but you are celebrating something that was living.
Yeah, I think my pieces are, the animals, they have an honor to them, that they have a dignity, a quiet dignity, I would say. But I'm also, I'm mourning them, the loss in them, but I'm also, there is some hope there still. So the piece about the Florida panther, I use a electroform seed pod, and one of them, like a bullseye right in the center of the head. So instead of being shot in the head, there's a seed pod in there. And that symbolizes the struggles with reproduction of the species. And also, it's an unwanted seed. It's just a nuisance from the farm. And I beg and plead with my husband not to pull them out of the garden. But they're really incredibly beautiful. And I think there's a metaphor there for maybe these unwanted apex predators that are roaming around in our urban environments. So there's a lot of metaphor I use in my work. But I see I give a small glimpse of hope with that sea pod and the bullseye there, and hoping that somehow they will make it. And actually, when I started the piece, there was thought to be 35 of them in the wild, and they've made them now with the Texas puma, a distant relative, and I think they brought 8 females in, and now there's maybe up to 200. So this is really exciting. I think there is just a wee bit of hope there. I think we all have to have that. I think
it's a great answer, because you've got yourself grieving in a way, and it's your way of processing our artists through that grief. But at the same time, you're creating something that does celebrate the life of something in a way that I would think enables others to understand why we should be upset about that. And I think that's really wonderful. That parallels, Jim, a lot of what you do. I would think that the reason you choose to work with youth is because there is hope. Sometimes when I hear you talk, I don't always hear the hope, but that's just part of you. But I you must be working with youth for a particular reason.
Well, it certainly is. I think it'd be very dark if I wasn't working with youth. And I want to, in the spirit of the presidential debate, not address your question right now, Mark. Instead, okay. What I want to do is talk about my experience of seeing Gina's work. And the circumstances under which I did was, I was self-isolated at home, not because I'd been exposed to COVID or had it, but because I was supposed to. This was early on in the pandemic. And but somehow, and that somehow is called Jill Dittmeyer, somehow I was lured out of my lair to go see go to an art gallery. And the folks at Harrison Center were super nice. They let me in the middle of the day. And I entered space of Gina's work. And one of the things that I'm grappling with, and my Climate Follies theater piece is really just sort of trying to take apart piece by piece is how do we grieve what is lost, and how do we grieve what is inevitably to be lost? I always start with the premise that the overwhelming majority of scientists are telling us that we are in a climate emergency, and that if we don't drastically reduce our impact on the environment, we're going to encounter unfathomable suffering and potentially extinction. And when you start from that premise, it kind of simplifies a lot of things. It makes it hard to have hope sometimes. And I'm still trying to figure out how I feel about this, but being in the space that Gina created with her beautiful pieces that were about mourning the loss of these beautiful creatures, it's our fault. We need these spaces to be able to grieve deeply this extraordinary moment in time where we get it. We understand it. And even if we don't get it on a scientific level, we get it in our bones. And that's why I think we're in this incredible upheaval during this period of time, is because the darkness is out. The shadow has been released. And everything's in the light now, from systemic racism to the sixth mass extinction to you name it. So I'm excited to be on this call. I always love being with Jill and Mark on this show. But to be here with Gina, who is really able to create a space for me, it created the space inside of myself to appreciate these extraordinary creatures that had lived, some of which, aren't coming back, and potentially all of them will cease to exist.
Yeah. And that's why we're talking about this today. That's Jim Poyser, the executive director of Earth Charter Indiana, also an author and playwright, along with Gina Westergaard, an artist and educator at the University of Kansas. We're talking about the art and science of environmental awareness. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back with more.
Rock and roll has evolved over the years from a sound that shaped the youth of a nation.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
To an era that started a rebellion.
We're the rebel, yeah. She cried more.
We're even bringing in a brand new generation. Every week on After Dark, we look through the songs and the stories that shaped rock and roll as we know it today.
After Dark, Sundays at 1 a.m. on 88.7 WICR.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope, furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're talking about the art and science of raising environmental awareness with our two guests, Gina Westergaard and Jim Poyser. And when we left, Gina, I know during that time you had a burning question you wanted to ask Jim, so go for that.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Jim for the description and the experience of my work. It really is, it stems from the heart. It stems from my experiences with the environment. So this is a topic, and I haven't really delved into it yet, but I'm sure Jim has some thoughts about it. So I'm thinking about the kind of the paradox we have is we're getting to the point on some of these endangered animals that they're going to probably be extinct in the wild in 10 years. Some of them, it may take up to 30 years, but it looks like a lot of them will be extinct. And so I'm interested in this idea where we're killing off these animals and plant life, but we'll stick to the animals. We're killing off the animals and we're putting them in zoos, the ones that we have still, they're left in zoos. And then we start this controversy topic about, will they be cloned? Is that how they're going to survive? And are they cloned just for our amusement in zoos when they're lost? So I don't know. This is something I'm starting to think about, just this idea of these endangered animal species being cloned in my artwork. Jim, do you have any ideas or thoughts about that?
Well, that's so interesting you say that, because, you know, one of the things that I marvel at is when I discover a period of time where I wasn't obsessed with the climate crisis. And you just reminded me of a time. There's an essay by John Berger, one of my most favorite authors of all time. And he wrote an essay called Why Look at Animals, grappling with that very issue. And I'm not sure cloning was a part of that, but I mean, this essay was like 30 years old or whatever. And I sort of picked that up in some other issues around zoos, and wrote an essay for a book that was edited by Susan Neville and somebody else. We're really going back into the old days here with this one. But, you know, it was all sort of linked around this visit I would make with my sons when they were very young, 4 and 6 years old, 6 and 8 years old, that sort of span of time. We'd go to the Indianapolis Zoo in the winter. There was nobody else there but the animals and the keepers of the zoo. And so I didn't have to watch other people watch animals. And it had this almost more immediate sense of the experience of being with an animal. And especially once you got to the desert biome. And at the end of this essay, which I guess is really creative nonfiction, I actually suggest that me and my sons are taking all of our clothes off to be in the desert biome. But that's not actually what happened. We just took our, you know, winter coats off and our gloves and our hats. But at the time, 30 years ago when I wrote this essay, you know, it was almost unimaginable heartbreak to consider that these animals might only be able to exist in zoos. And 30 years later, we're on a path of destruction. And COVID, when all is said and done, I think 2020, we will see a fall of 7% carbon emissions. And that's exactly, well, that's not really quite enough, but we need to decrease our carbon emissions by 7 to 10% over the next 10 years if we want to preserve the habitat for these animals, right? It took a global pandemic for us to even approach the goals that we need to hit each year. So do with that what you will. The point being, we need radical ideas. And E.O. Wilson, the great ant researcher and biologist and thinker, has something I think he calls the half world theory. We need to literally give animals. We need to preserve biodiversity on half the earth. And it's an extraordinary idea. I don't know how we'd ever get there, but we're at the point where we need ideas that are that ambitious.
You know, it's interesting. In the work that I do with students on urban ecology right now, one of the things that I have them reading is a book by a fairly prolific author who really tackles what you're talking about, Jim, and that is Doug Talamay. He's been here in central Indiana several times and spoken. His new book is Nature's Best Hope. And he really addresses EO's idea of how we would get there. And he is addressing it. And Gina, I think this segues right nicely into what you guys are trying to do, into our own private land that we have. You know, our backyard in an urban setting, or if it's not in an urban setting, it's our land, that the only way we can get past this total privatization that we have in the United States, because that is king, is to really look at, we're not going to be able to take back lands from people and make them public, but we can take lands that are private and turn them. So Gina, how, tell me about you and your husband and this whole organic movement that you've tried to do, and how that helps with, you know, your love of animals and all that.
Well, my husband has an organic produce farm, and that's several acres. And he just got a grant for a hoop house, so we'll be able to grow vegetables year round. And
can you describe the hoop house, Gina? It's not
everybody. I'm sorry. A greenhouse. A greenhouse.
This is what a hoop house is, I think.
Well, it's a greenhouse. So
made out of just hoops with.
Well, plastic. Yeah, it's plastic.
Yeah.
So. Right. So he's actually writing grants right now to involve more kids in this process and to bring them out and not really have a yuppie designer farm, but really be involved with the land. So we have 137 acres.
Wow.
And part of that is woods and natural floodplains. We have two creeks that run through. So it's a lot of opportunity for to engage kids in this. But yeah, what was your question? I'm going off topic here, but
how that has transferred, how that idea of taking back your own part of the world,
doing it by incorporating it into your art, so even more people are able and be affected by it, like Jim so eloquently spoke. And I have to agree, I had the same feeling. It really tugged at my heart. It made me stop and think not only about animals, but the environment, because of all the different materials that you used in it. And it was not, it was beautiful. It was very beautiful. It was not ugly. It was not frightening at all. It really made a difference for me.
I think being part of that environment, I'm, you know, classic city girl, born and raised in Southern California, speaking of zoos, so spent a lot of time at zoos. So being introduced to that lifestyle and that environment really did change my ideas about death and how it's just part of the process. And I'm not a great animal behavioralist, or I study at animals because I'm always out to try to save them all. So it doesn't work too well, but it's been interesting. I mean, again, we do organic produce, and my husband wanted to raise cattle when he met me, and not eating mammals. We went a different route. And then after a few years, he really wanted to do chickens. Of course, this is all good for fertilizer for his organic garden. And then I talked him out of chickens because I said, well, everything loves to eat chickens out in the country. And I don't know, I don't have the heart for that. So now he's raising worms, and it makes really good fertilizer. And he proudly says he's a worm rancher, and that's okay with me. I don't get emotionally involved or attached with the worms. So it works out really well in our quite little environment. And I feel, especially with COVID, I feel like I'm a billionaire because I have this property that I can take walks on daily, and you know, I take hikes, and that definitely influences and goes right into my work. So I feel
you mentioned a word, Gina, that I think is really important, and you both have this at your core, and that is behavior. And I think as artists, part of what you do is you don't do it just for yourself, but you do it to influence others. and the behavior of others. And so, Jim, through your art as a writer of doing plays, and Gina, through your art memorializing things that we're losing, I think both of you are making not more than a statement and more than something that helps you, but you're also hoping to influence others. Can you talk a little bit more about that, both of you? What's your hope in doing your art? What do you hope it would do for others?
Well, the first thing I hope is that my proposal is we don't air this episode. We just go live at Gina's property, right, to ride out the apocalypse. Because if you air this episode, everybody's going to want to go ride out the apocalypse at Gina's.
With the worms.
With the worms, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you asked me this before the break, Mark, I believe, about hope. And the reason I work with kids is because I take hope and despair off the equation completely. Because I can't afford the luxury of hope and despair. The planet that we are leaving to these children is going to be horrific if we don't work very hard now to preserve it.
And don't you think that your kids, your Earth Charter kids, are doing that, Jim? I think that's one of the great hopes of all time, is that you're starting them young so they get this from the get-go, and it's very important to them. These causes that they've changed laws in the state of Indiana and ordinances.
Right, right. So you're absolutely right, and they are demonstrating that. And there are a group of kids now that have decided that they want the elected leaders of Indiana to declare a climate emergency. Now, we can do another story about that for another time, because that gets us really into some really exciting new prospects that these kids are engaged in. But for me personally, taking the hope and despair off the table is the only way to keep going at this point. And I think, like, one of my plays in the package of Climate Follies is called Career Day. And this was sparked by the real experience of going to schools to talk to kids about careers. That's what they ask me to do, they being the teachers or whatever. And I go in, I'm talking to third and fourth and fifth grade kids about their career paths. Well, 80% of me, I'm going to talk about drawdown. I'm going to talk about all the things they can do, including being an organic farmer, right? But 20% of me is like going like, oh my God, is the world even going to exist for these kids in 20 years by the time they are on their career path? So instead of just pushing that particular dark, cynical thought away, I turned it into a little musical called Career Day. The outside person coming in is talking about career paths, but the kids start responding with these absurd ideas. Anyway, you'll have to see it at Indie Fringe next year. Let's hope it actually happens. And I used the word hope, so that's perfect.
Gina? You remember the question?
The hope.
But in your work, there is a reason that you put it in the public. Otherwise, you just have it for yourself. You'd create it and enjoy it. Why do you put it out there?
What's the reaction then to the show that we saw here in Indiana, and you staged your art around the country too? What do people say?
You know, they're drawn to it for sure. I feel like I make my work for other people. I want to raise awareness, obviously, with the topics we're talking about, but it's also, you know, being a visual artist, you're making something, you're telling a story visually, and maybe communicating these ideas through a different means. I mean, we need all the help we can get, right?
Right.
So, I think that's part of it. I don't understand loss and death, but I make my work to hope to maybe offer somebody else can understand it in some way, a glimpse into their healing process or their cognitive process about thinking about where we fit in the future of our planet.
Do you do that with your students too, Gina? Do you not just teach them the technique of the art and the craft, but ways for their art to have meaning, for it to have purpose? Is that still a lesson that's being taught or needs to be taught more?
Oh yeah, obviously. I'm always stressing that. I just gave my students a project and I said, the paradox of, I think, being an artist is the more personal you can get with your work, the more universal it becomes to others. And I think if you're working with something through experience and through the heart, your passions, however you want to say it, it's genuine, and that power is felt in your work. So I always try to encourage my students to tell their stories in their work, whether it be jewelry or a vessel or a piece of sculpture.
And you know, I think that's really interesting because that storytelling, right, that form of storytelling is what artists do. And stories have the ability to move us, to help us move somewhere. Sometimes our language is really limited in our ability to say, so I think, Gina, the fact that you can create visual representations where people can create their own language. And I think of theater in the same way, people fill in for what's not there. Both of those are forms that you're allowing people to create their own thoughts and you're getting them excited and thinking about things that are maybe too difficult for us to even understand ourselves. Very powerful.
Mm-hmm. And Jim, because you have been involved with theater for a long time, have you noticed that more, that people now are more willing and wanting to not just be entertained, but to be informed and educated when they do go to the theater? And is that helping overall?
Well, I think we need all the in-person spaces to collaborate and be in communities that we can get. And what COVID has done is really, really pushed us into the fragmentation of our screens, except, of course, for all the people that are going to the bars anyway because they don't care. So I would say that, you know, it's been fun for me to get to know a bunch of theater artists who are working on the climate crisis. And they aren't in this area so much. I kind of feel like, you know, like I did the Fringe a few years ago. I did the Saving the World Through Bumper Stickers comedy show. And I kind of felt like I was the token climate change guy. Fortunately, I think that's changing as more and more people are grappling with these enormous issues. By and large, I don't, you know, it's the age of COVID. I went to a Fonseca theater play recently that was really quite a lot of fun, and we were outdoors and it was just it was a great experience. But now that it's getting colder and we're all driven back indoors again, seeing theater is now a distant fantasy.
But even before COVID, I mean, the Earth Charter's been around before COVID, and your kids are continuing to make progress. And I mean, they're identifying problems in their schools and in their cities. And these are causes that they want to get behind and make change. So I do feel that the work that both of you are doing is getting through to that younger generation that does want to take action with something. And once again, that's why it's so important that we do incorporate art and science when it comes to big, difficult issues. And we hand it to people at a young age. It shouldn't all just be held back until you get into high school or college or can get, you know, a better understanding of everything. You kind of have to get out and experience it and get behind it.
Well, we've learned the facts are not that persuasive. They certainly persuade me, but most people are not persuaded by the facts. The facts of climate change, the facts of the sixth mass extinction, are extraordinarily difficult to comprehend. but so is the story about it. The scientists are trying to tell us, not just through facts, but through whatever, their tweets, their speeches, whatever. We're in this incredible period of time where scientists are crying out to be heard. And so we're at this point where the facts are unimaginable, but so is the story. So, Jill, to your point, what we need, I think, is a new form of storytelling that maybe the kids can help us find. Because the Western narrative story structure falls apart in the face of climate catastrophe. There's no 11th hour hero going to save us. There's no happy ending here. And we don't know how to fathom that with the structure, even in the, you know, the 15-second commercial narrative structure. We don't know how to fathom that. What we do have is the ability to visualize the world we want to live in. And that may or may not have a story arc to it. It may just be a description, either through words, song, visual, dance, you name it, of a world where we are collaborating and cooperating and making sure that we're creating space for everything, for all the different kinds of people that we are. And then, as per E.O. Wilson, for half the earth given to biodiversity so that we can survive.
So we, you know, when I look at the role of artists in these tough science issues, and you're right, how do we communicate science to the public is something that I'm deeply involved in, why we have this radio show. And I do believe that the arts are a gateway. I do believe they're a gateway to understanding. I do believe that it won't be just the children that you have, but artists themselves will find new modalities, new ways of expressing, and more effective ways. I'm very hopeful. We've had people on our show before who work, for instance, at IU Health, and work in improving the communications of healthcare professionals, including doctors, using the arts. We've had other guests who have looked at art therapy and ways in which that can make improvements. So I think we are trying to change the narrative, and I think we are trying to improve the way in which science communicates. As scientists have been given a really tough job in that they have to be able to understand very complex things, but then turn around and be able to speak to non-scientists with a really poor science education system in the United States. And so it's very complicated for us to deliver that. But I see lots and lots of hope within that, that we're creating through the arts, new avenues to help people to understand some of the relationships. Gina, it impresses me the kind of work that goes into when you celebrate, you hold up and you celebrate something that was, which has been kind of your work, that all of a sudden you create for people this way to access it, right? To access their own feelings. Isn't that a part of what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it goes beyond the sciences. I think it goes into our cultural, our culture, how we're trained or not trained to deal with our emotions. I mean, I started making funerary urns because I don't think we have any context in our society anymore for which to place these feelings or observations about death, and a lot of and people do it's hard sometimes for people to understand my work, you know, the funerary urns, because it's blatantly about passing and death and mourning, but that's why I wanted to do it, because I don't see us dealing with it, and I think that relates to what's happening right now and what Jim's talking about is it's like we can't even comprehend a passing of somebody, let alone a passing of our whole environment or our whole species. So I think that's kind of, and that's what I was trying to do as an artist, to try to make up for something that maybe our society is lacking in some way. So it's almost like a vehicle to help people just deal with death and loss.
I agree, because a lot of times we turn to music. I mean, musicians are usually pretty right on it, you know, to address those kinds of issues. And music is something that everyone can relate to. But I still think visual arts kind of scare people sometimes. They look at something and they're panicked. I got to say something about this. Do I like it? Do I not? Do I have to say something profound about this? No, it just needs to affect you in one way or the other.
Yeah, I agree. I had somebody who was saw a piece of mine and it stayed in his mind for over a year, and then I ran into it again and he wanted to purchase it, which I thought was fantastic. And I sent him all the information, my artist statement and all the information about my work. It scared him right out of buying it. He said, you know, I didn't hear back from him for a long time. And then he was really apologetic. And he said, you know, I just freaked me out so bad. I just can't deal with it. And I thought, okay, oh, it's all right. You know, it's really understandable, but it's a piece of art. It can be whatever you want it to be. But, that's what I say. We don't really have a mechanism in our society, I don't think, to really process this. And
well, it's fascinating too. This is Jim, just thinking about the narrative arc of storytelling, theater, writing, movies, that sort of thing, versus the experience of a piece of visual art. You know, I mean, I know I'm stating the obvious here, but this conversation is really kind of peeling a layer off for me of the disparity between those experiences, and that, again, going back to being in that room with Gina's art, that I had the opportunity, you know, mask in over my face, thinking about my own potential death, thinking about the sixth mass extinction and my role in it, to just be with this feeling. And, you know, then who knows what you do with it, right? Maybe I leave the gallery and I redouble my efforts to work on the half earth theory, or I'm going to work 80 hours a week instead of 70 now with these amazing kids in Indiana, or I'm going to go home and cry and just not be able to function for a couple days. I don't know. I mean, that's up to each and every person.
Yeah. And that's why we got to wrap things up here. Unfortunately, this has been just a really insightful conversation, and we thank both of you for being with us. I want to let you each give us a quick. I know Jim, you've got your new book, The Lost Actor. Where can people find that?
Well, yes. So The Last Actor and Other Stories is available at Amazon.com, and my other project, Climate Follies, is launching as a podcast. So you can go to climatefollies.com and you can listen to our podcast, and you can sign up for subsequent podcasts. And of course, someday it will be performed live with people.
We can't wait to see that. And Gina, your work, where can we find more of your work and support your work as well?
Well, right now, the best way to do that is to find my website, and it's ginawestergaard.com, GINAWESTERGARD.com. The COVID has affected some avenues of for artists these days. It's been tough for us to find real exhibition menus. So it was a great experience at the Harrison Center of the Arts to be able to do that in person.
Well, we appreciate you both, and we thank you both for sharing with us today, and for all of our listeners at home, Mark. And we have a way for them to learn more about Gina and Jim and our other guests as well, don't we?
You'll be able to find pictures about projects, the links that they mentioned we will have on our website, thedaVinciPursuit.com. It's where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And we hope you'll join us again when we do that again. And until then, I am Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to
stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on thedaVinciPursuit.com. Or you can join your hosts, Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling, here every Saturday at 1 p.m. on A Different Kind of Public Radio, 88.7 WICR.